1, 2, 3.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, home of the song story, which we define as stories about moments or times in your life that are automatically revived whenever you hear a certain song. Thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. Our guest this week is Preston Rumbaugh. Preston is a roots music veteran now based in Clarksdale, Mississippi, known as the home of the blues because blues music basically originated there, where he's a member of the Big A and the All-Stars Blues Trio. He also leads his own blues band that features Big A and the All-Stars members Anthony Big A Sherrod and Lee Williams, and he plays solo gigs. Preston hails originally from what's referred to as Old Nashville, where he played alongside music legends like Scotty Moore, Dale Watson, Lucinda Williams, Ronnie Hawkins, and many others. As a young musician, Preston toured domestically and internationally with the Scottish rockabilly band Shaken Pyramids. In the 2000s, he backed Memphis recording artist John Paul Keith before he decided to settle in Clarksdale to play blues exclusively. Since making that move, Preston has backed a who's who of blues legends, including Robert Bilbo Walker, Big George Brock, and Terry Big T. Williams, and he's a regular at festivals like the Juke Joint Festival in Clarksdale and venues like Ground Zero Blues Club. He was in town to play with Big A and the All-Stars on the FGCU campus, so we brought him by the studio to pick his brain about his life and his three songs. Good afternoon, Preston. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
Been to this part of Florida before?
Never have.
No? What do you think?
Oh, it's a different planet, man. It's beautiful down here.
Yeah. How'd it go last night?
Excellent. Everybody seemed to be happy about it.
Explain what exactly the band is comprised of. It's Big A and the All-Stars. Where do you fit into the Big A and the All-Stars lineup?
Well, I'm the bass player. Anthony Sherrod is a vocalist, guitar player. He's multi-instrumentalist, as a matter of fact, but he plays guitar and sings. His cousin Lee Williams plays drums, and they're both born and raised in Clarksdale and have been doing it all their lives, fundamentally speaking. And I've been with them for some number of years, on and off, more on lately than off. But I've been playing, I'm 67 years old, and I've been playing music for more than 40 years. Hmm. I've played in dozens of bands, and beyond the shadow of a doubt, this one is my favorite one. I have more fun playing in this band than I have had in any band prior.
You are playing bass with this band. Is that, like, in the spectrum of your 40-plus years playing music, how much of that time has been spent as a bass player?
I'd say most of it. I'd say 75% okay. of it or so. I've played some guitar in bands as well.
Hmm. So where did you grow up, and how would you describe the musical background of your childhood?
Well, I was born in West Texas. I was born in Odessa, Texas. My grandfather was an oil man. He was, you know, our last name's Rumbaugh, and he was born in like 1902 up in Pennsylvania amongst the Pennsylvania Dutch. And they drilled oil up in Pennsylvania. And of course, they moved to more fertile fields in Louisiana and Texas. So I was born in Odessa, Texas in 1956. And not long after I was born, my granddad wanted to, you know, retire out of the oil fields and raise cattle. So he and my grandmother toured Middle Tennessee looking for grass, farmland that they could raise cattle on. And they bought a couple of farms in Hickman County and a couple in Dixon County. So I grew up just west of Nashville in Dixon County, which, you know, at that time was a farming community. And anymore, it's like a bedroom. It's a bedroom community for Nashville.
What about music? Like, what was happening around you? What were your folks listening to? Was there music being played in the house?
Oh, you know, there's yeah, we had record players and records. And my father was a big fan of like Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals and whatnot. And of course, we grew up watching the Beatles. You know, saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show. We collected all the Beatles albums and Rolling Stones. I remember seeing Chubby Checker on television doing the twist before I saw the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
On the Ed Sullivan show. So, you know, typical, you know, middle class music experience.
Instruments being played around the house at all?
Oh, we had ukuleles when we were kids. I ran over mine with a tractor.
Did you take it seriously, or was it a toy or an instrument?
I don't know that you could say I took it seriously, but yeah, I enjoyed playing on the things. I remember I took and poked a hole in the face of my ukulele so I could stick a guitar jack in it and pretend that it was an electric guitar.
Huh. Yeah. When was the last time you played a ukulele?
Oh, God. Decades.
So you didn't get swept up into the ukulele increasing whatever happened 12
years
ago?
Well, the next step was the Sears Silvertone guitar. That, if I recall correctly, looking at the Sears catalog back in the mid-60s, you could get the Sears, you know, Danelectro manufactured Silvertone guitar in the case with a little built-in amplifier. And that set sold, like, I'm talking like 1965, you could get that set for $16.
Wow.
And so we had one. I remember playing on that thing. And yeah, so, you know, just went on from our cousin of ours had a 1961 Gibson Les Paul Jr., you know, double cutaway is like an SG, double cutaway 1P90 at the bridge, and a Fender Champ amplifier. And man, that thing, that rig was an absolute joy because, you know, that little Champ amplifier was a 5-watt tube amp. And, you know, the Gibson guitar had a P90 in it. And, man, you could turn that thing all the way up and just...
Did he know what he was doing with it?
Hell no. He loaned it to us.
did any of you guys know what you were doing with it?
No, but I sure had fun trying to figure out what I was doing. I remember I would strut around pretending I was Eric Clapton with it. Oh, it just enjoyed the hell out of the sound that you could get out of that Gibson through that Fender amp, you know, cranked.
Hmm.
Oh, that was a wonderful rig.
What was the first band or musician that got your attention that wasn't from your folks or something like that, something that you sort of identified with? You've mentioned the Beatles. You mentioned Chubby Checker. But what was your first band? You know what I mean?
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, I could tell you about bands I saw as a teenager growing up in Knoxville, Tennessee. There was the street that ran right down the edge of the campus's University Avenue. But it's referred to as Cumberland Avenue, excuse me. But it's referred to as the Strip, and there were rock and roll clubs up and down, you know, that catered to the student body from the University of Tennessee. But the first band I ever saw that really got my attention was in Dixon County. I was telling Roger about this just the other day. It was in Dixon County at the Dixon County Fair, you know, which always came around in the fall. And so you got the midway with all the sawdust and the circus rides, you know, all the tilt-a-whirl and all that stuff. But they had a small circus tent set up. And this was at night, illuminated by Christmas tree lights everywhere, you know, county fair. And they had a hoochie-coochie show in that circus tent, which I was not old enough to get into. It was, you know, adults only. But to attract people to the tent, they set up a flatbed trailer and had a black band play on that trailer. And I remember being attracted to the sound of the band. It's like, what's that? And I run over there. And on that flatbed trailer was, you know, about four black guys. And they had the most primitive collection of instruments I ever saw in my life. It looked like they had made guitars out of tennis rackets and broom handles. It looked like they were using old radios for amplifiers, cardboard boxes substituted as drums. But when they played, the sound they produced was just awe-inspiring. I was like, oh, my God, listen to the sound these guys can get out of those instruments. And I remember being deeply impressed by what they accomplished with what they had. I mean, I really didn't think that much about what they had. I was more impressed by, listen to the sound.
Yeah, and these you still remember it clearly
to this day.
It clearly got to you.
Yeah, it was the first band I ever saw, first live band I ever saw. I might have been 10 years old.
Huh.
But I was just blown away by them.
Hmm. We're going to get to your first song, but when did you get a guitar that was finally a guitar that you took seriously?
My granddad bought me a bass, actually. It was a 72 model Fender Telecaster bass in about 1974.
So you would have been about?
Oh, 16, 17 maybe.
Okay.
And that was my first, you know, genuinely serious instrument.
Hmm. Did you, like, take lessons? Did you?
No, I would go. At the time, I was living, I left home early. I left home when I was 15 years old. And, you know, so I.
Left home for where?
Well, I left Dick's, long
a
story.
A bunch of friends' houses?
Well, my older brother was going to the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. So, you know, I had to leave home. I could not stay there. So I went to Knoxville. And initially stayed with my brother and his friends. I'd sleep on the couch in a dorm room on campus. But then I sort of graduated to my own place in the Fort Sanders area that was, you know, right across Cumberland Avenue from the university. So to support myself, I would work in the restaurants up and down Cumberland Avenue. And, you know, when the job, you know, when the kitchens closed at about 10 o'clock, all the rock clubs that catered to the students were, you know, just starting. So, and I had no parents that I had to report to. I had no curfew. So I would go hang out in the rock clubs and watch.
Talk about a free range kid.
Oh, yeah, I was absolutely free range. But yeah, I'd go hang out in the rock club. I had jobs in the rock clubs, washing dishes, you know, and when the kitchen closed, I was free to go into the bar room and watch the bands play. So I learned how to play watching those guys. I spent a lot of time in Nashville as well as a late teen, down on Lower Broadway in the mid-70s. I split my time between Nashville and Knoxville. But in the mid-70s in Nashville, the Opry had just moved away from the Ryman and out to Opryland. And that left Lower Broadway at that time in its absolute trough of urban decline. It was Skid Row. And there was nothing down there. The Ryman was boarded up, and there was nothing down there but the bar rooms that had catered to the overflow crowds of the old Opry. There was a furniture store. There were a couple of pawn shops. Gruen's Guitars was down there at the time. And the musicians that played in those barrooms had essentially been left behind when the Opry moved out to Opryland. So they continued to play the same barrooms that they had played for decades. But the audiences were gone. I like to tell people, and it's true, that at that time in the mid-70s, there were 30 people on Lower Broadway every night. And it was the same 30 people on Lower Broadway every night. You might occasionally see a tourist, and you would identify them as a tourist because they were strangers. But the music in those barrooms down on Lower Broadway at that time was some of the richest I ever heard. Because when you're in that socioeconomic context, there is no reason for you or anyone else to be pretentious about anything. And those guys were all pretty much heartbroken because, you know, at the end of their twilight years, they had been abandoned. So the country music I heard coming out of those barrooms was amazingly rich, poignant. And, you know, I would go home. I would be down there from 6 o'clock in the evening till 2 o'clock in the morning. I rode a bicycle up and down Lebanon Road. I lived out in Donaldson. And I would ride the bicycle home after 2 o'clock And I would stay up until 6 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out what I had witnessed on guitar.
Yeah.
I would sleep from 6 o'clock in the morning until about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, get up, you know, eat whatever, ride back down there, and I'd be back down there at 6 o'clock at night, and I'd watch both, all the bands on the street. They played shifts from 6 to 10 and from 10 to 2, and I would watch, I would take in every band in the course of the evening.
Well, we will get to some more of your storytelling because it's not so shabby there, Preston. I love what you got to say. Let's listen to your first song, though. Do you want to tell a story? Do you want to, you know, how do you want to handle it?
Oh, well, that's just, it's more a story about our grandfather than me, really.
Well, no, that's great. You're in charge now.
Be careful what you wish for.
That's what Big A told me yesterday.
I'm just like him. Hey, don't listen to a word
he says.
I told
him I was going to call him out on it. And he said, don't do it. But I guess I just did.
Well, my granddad, he, as I told you earlier, he was born in Pennsylvania amongst the Dutch up there. And they drilled oil and then moved down south and drilled oil. And long story short, that's what he did. That's what his family did. And there was, you know, and it was an extended family. There were good number of Rumbaughs out in West Texas at that time, but the way I hear it told was that if you needed oil to come out of the ground, you'd get a hold of my granddad and he'd make it happen for you. And he was all business and he was stoic. He was not a conversationalist. In my entire life, I'll bet I never heard him utter a paragraph. But they say that he was the first to put oil derricks on wheels. He said, why in the hell are we building these things when we can just move them around? And I also recall there was a John Wayne movie that came out in the mid-60s called The Hellfighters. And John Wayne portrayed a character out in West Texas whose task it was to put out oil well fires. And we saw the movie, and at the end of the movie, my granddad simply said, I knew that guy. And that was it.
I knew that. That was four of the 50 words you heard him say.
Just about. My grandmother was a real Bible thumper. So we would all load up in the car and go. We would drive into Nashville every Sunday and go to church, you know, First Christian Church on Franklin Road, where I was baptized about 1965 or so. But in the course of the service, you know, the congregation we'd all stand up and sing, you know, these songs, religious songs. And my granddad would stand up with everybody else, but he would not open his mouth. He would not move his lips. And when the song was
over, wouldn't even mouth the words?
No, absolutely not. He would stand up and just stand there. And when the song was over, he'd sit back down. And all the Rodgers and Hammerstein that my dad played and all the Beatles and the Stones and, you know, everything on TV, I never saw him respond to any of it. So I just assumed that none of that registered with him.
Right.
That he did not entertain music. So then in the mid-70s, Merle Haggard produced a record and sang. He hired the original Playboys, or what original Playboys he could, you know, that were left. And Bob Wills was unable to perform. He had suffered a stroke and was in a wheelchair, but Bob Wills attended the recording sessions. Merle Haggard did the vocal parts. And so you had Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys together. The name of the album, I believe, was For the Last Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a double album set, if memory serves me well. And I had it on cassette tape. And I had a boombox. And I was in the living room of my granddad's house playing Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And I just loved it, you know, because the instrumental, it was Western swing. It was swing music.
Yeah.
It's like Bob Wills and Texas Playboys were playing swing, and Count Basie and his orchestra were playing swing. And the two forms were quite similar. There's more strings in Texas than there were They were using more horns. You know, Count Basie was just using more horns. But it was the same stuff, man. It was like up-tempo. It jumped. It grooved. It, you know, there was all kind of chord changing. It was great stuff. Wonderful, joyful music. So I'm playing Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys on a boombox in the living room. And I was astonished to see my grandfather leap up out of his reclining chair and begin to dance.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said. My God. Gramps, what is into you? And he did not stop dancing. He was grinning from ear to ear, and he looks at me, and he's dancing while he's talking to me. I was astonished. He says, that's the Texas Playboys. He said, when I was your age, I would drive my Cadillac 100 miles one way to see them perform. And it was, you know, so revelatory. It's like, yes, thank God.
Grandpa has an internal life.
Yeah, he at one point in time, I think it was my grandmother, you know, she was thumping the Bible. And I think that she just, you know, repressed all, you know, hope of having fun in his life from the time he married her on. But I'm sure that he saw the Texas Playboys and had himself a whale of a time before he ever met her. So anyway, I was just real happy to see that my granddad had experienced that and, you know, took it in and treated it the way that it, you know, that it worked its wonders on him at that time. I envy him. I would have loved to see the Texas Playboys in some West Texas dance hall in, you know, 1942.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
So the song you brought us is the first song off that double album.
Oh, any song off that double album would have done, but you know, I think it's the introductory song.
We're the Texas
Playboys, yep, from the Lone Star State.
Well, let's listen to it. Thinking of that, this is Preston Rumbaugh's first song on this week's Three Song Stories. It's Texas Playboys theme, or actually just called Playboy Theme by Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, from the album For the Last Time, recorded in 1973.
All right, must have been about 1976 or 77. I spent the summer living in an apartment building on Elliston Place, right across the street from the Exit Inn, which at that time, the Exit Inn was a singer-songwriter's club. It was real small, intimate. I mean, if you got about 30 people in there, it was full. But the Texas Playboys came to the Exit Inn that summer. And boy, I was there. And the thing about it was, I was the only young man in the club. It was, and all the Playboys from Texas knew all the guys. And it was like I had crashed a senior musician's reunion party. It was one of the most joy-filled club events I ever witnessed. Those guys were they were all musicians. They were all some of the finest musicians in Nashville. And they were all so happy to see one another again and still be able to play that they were literally weeping tears of joy. And the Playboys, there was still Al Strickland on piano, and Leon McAuliffe was on steel. They had to be in their late 70s, if not early 80s, and they still sounded spectacular. And when they played, they all bounced up and down, and it was just the cutest thing you ever saw, but it sounded just wonderful. There was a black and white glossy 8x10 promotional photograph of the group, and it was inserted with all the little individual pictures of everyone in the band. And it was on the board, like behind the bar. I ripped it off and took it into the club and had all of them sign it.
You still have it?
No, I let a friend of mine hang on to it for safekeeping, and while he had it in his possession, his house burned down.
So
I lost it.
That's a pretty good excuse. I mean, it's a bad excuse, but you can't blame him, I guess.
Oh, no, not at all. But it was, I just feel really fortunate to have been able to witness that. I'm sure it was among the last few gigs those guys ever played together.
Did seeing your grandpa get up and dance change anything in terms of your understanding of him or your interactions with him from that part forward?
Oh, it didn't necessarily change my interactions with him, but it certainly changed the way
he
I
went
perceived.
Back to being stoic after that, though.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He shut it all
it
down.
It wasn't
after
a pivot to a whole new way.
No, no. But it allowed me a glimpse into
sure.
what he was at one yeah. point in time.
Yeah.
And it told me that he was a lot more fully developed than I ever suspected.
And that applies to like humanity too. Suddenly you learn a little lesson about what it's like to be a grown-up. Well, we normally start here by saying, you know, where did you fit into the scene in high school? But based on the way you described things, it didn't sound like you really did a ton of high school, or do I have the time right?
You'd be pretty much right. After I left home, I attended West High School in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Okay, so you did do school on your own.
Not really.
Sorta.
You know, I had no parental supervision. And, you know, I was trying to see how much fun I could have.
Yeah.
And, you know, marijuana was all the thing at the time. And rock and roll shows would come to the Coliseum. And there were rock and roll bands playing all up and down Cumberland Avenue. I was much more interested in all of that than I was high school. I couldn't. What in the hell do you need this for? On top of that, I had to sustain myself. I had to work,
right.
You know. And
yeah, you were a single-income household.
Yeah, I remember the football coach at West High School looks at me and says, man, you want to play football? I said, yeah, I'd love to, but I got to work. I got to wash dishes. So, no, I didn't do a whole lot of high school. I got kicked out of there, I think, my sophomore and junior years, and I was there in my senior year, and I said, oh, to hell with this, and I quit.
When did you start taking music seriously enough to put you on a path to what led to where you are today?
Oh, right about that time, you know, because I began studying those rock musicians that I saw, you know, in the clubs of Cumberland Avenue, and we were putting together our first high school bands and whatnot. And my brother was a music major, and so he had a lot of, you know, I had to go over to the music building at UT and watch the UT jazz band play, and he helped me score, you know, good bass amps. The next thing I know, I'm playing like in a high school band. We've got a drummer and a great guitar player. A buddy of mine played. He was dedicated enough to work and earn enough money to buy a Les Paul. He had a Les Paul and a Marshall.
That band have a name?
Oh, no. We were just three kids.
Okay.
We played. We never played a gig. We just played.
Right.
A church loaned us some space, and so we would set our amps and the drum set up, and then we never had a PA, but we would play the guitar parts and drums, and so we had a trio. So we were just trying to figure out how to play. But, man, I was playing that Telecaster bass. My brother scored me. He knew some guys that were, you know, pretty wealthy, and, you know, they just go through gear like the rest of us go through socks. And I wound up with an Ampeg V4B amplifiers, 100-watt amplifier, tube amplifier, sitting on top of an SVT cabinet, and it had 810s in it. So it was, you know, an awesome rock and roll bass amp. And I was using Rotosound round wound strings on a Telecaster. The Telecaster had a humbucker at the neck, so I could, you know, I could do the full chord thing with those Rotosounds and that humbucker and that Ampeg. Christ, that thing could push some air.
You look so happy right now as you're describing that. It's joyous. When were you finally in a band that had a name? Or when did you play your first paying gig? Whichever of the two came first.
That would have been out of Nashville, you know, so I'd moved from Knoxville back to Nashville, and I'd find myself on Lower Broadway. And by the time I was about 20 years old, I'd figured out that, you know, you could hang out in the bar rooms in Nashville and get yourself a gig, you know, playing in. So you're just playing in these country band, questionable country bands from Nashville. And, you know, you'd be playing in honky-tonks, playing. you'd be playing for a bunch of white trash, but it was money.
Yeah.
It beat, you know, having to work a square job. And that was, you know, at that stage, that was the object of the game, was to avoid the square job and get paid for playing music.
When did you have your last square job?
Jeez, It's been years, been decades. But I can remember a time I worked down on 2nd Avenue in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Nashville Sash and Door Company. You know, putting glass in windows and doors. We were up on the 5th floor of one of the oldest buildings in Nashville. And from the 5th floor, I had a view of the Cumberland River. And across the Cumberland River was the Nashville Bridge Company, and they'd be building barges. And at the time, I had a little cassette player, and I'd be listening to John Hartford sing about, you know, riverboats. And see, at the foot of Broadway when the Delta Queen comes in, that kind of thing. But, Nashville is just it was a different world back in the 70s. You know, those clubs up and down lower Broadway and the musicians in them. So I pretty much wound up playing country music out of those bar rooms, you know, initially.
You've been on some records. I found you part of some records. When did you start doing any kind of recording work?
The first recording work I did was with a group out of Scotland by the name of the Shaken Pyramids.
Oh, yeah. I meant I watched like a video or, you know, listened to one of their songs, and I was like, oh, that's not at all. I mean, it was cool, but it was like kind of swingy, kind of, I don't know how to describe it.
It was rockabilly.
Rockabilly, that's the word I was looking for.
I described that group as, you know, people asked me, what were they like? I just said, well, they were just like, kind of like the Everly Brothers on speed. And a buddy of mine in high school, I met a fellow by the name of Kurt Deeds. His father was a professor at UT in educational psychology. And they had sent him and his family, including Kurt, you know, around the world, you know, in his studies. So, and Kurt had spent some time in London as a teenager. And he was an avid the most serious music fan I've ever seen. He wound up managing a record store. But in the mid-70s, I'm going to high school. I meet this guy, Kurt. He's been to London. He's seen The Who. He's seen Led Zeppelin. He knows all the bands. He taught me all about the finer points of rock and roll music. And in the late 70s, we, you know, discovered, you know, the roots of Peter Gralnick was coming out. He came out with Feel Like Going Home and Lost Highway. And we avidly read those books. Greil Marcus, Mystery Train. So, you know, next thing we're collecting all the records, all the blues records, all the rockabilly records, all the country records. And we're realizing that, Christ, we're in the middle. You know, we have grown up in the absolute middle of the heart of American music. And then we learn that there's about to be a rockabilly revival in England. And Kurt had lived in London years prior, and he wanted to go back. So when he graduated college in 80, the two of us took off in early 81 for London. And long story short, I was fortunate enough to land a gig playing bass with this band that was signed to the Virgin record label. And I did some recording with them. But mostly it was just touring. Hmm. They had a hit record because rockabilly was popular at the time, and it was a good band. And so we constantly worked. And, so I got to see all of Britain, all of Europe, even went behind the Iron Curtain.
Had you ever been overseas before that? Or was new? You're like, I'm in Europe playing rockabilly.
That was the first time I ever flew on a plane. Huh. We flew out of Atlanta to London in February of 81. I arrived in London with $400 and no return ticket. And I went broke before I landed a gig. It was really interesting.
I like your style. Let's do this Elvis song.
All right.
How do you want to handle it?
Oh, just let her rip.
We're going to let her rip. All right, this is our guest today, Preston Rumbaugh, second song. He's, I was going to say Nashville born, but you're Odessa, Texas born, Nashville raised, Clarksdale, Mississippi based. How's that?
That's good.
Musician. This is Good Rockin' Tonight, recorded by Elvis Presley in 1964 during the Sun Sessions. You're listening to Three Song Stories, Biography Through Music.
There was a time I played bass for, have you ever heard of Ronnie McDowell?
Is he an actor?
No, he was a
singer. There's some McDowell actors. No, I don't think I do.
Well, Ronnie McDowell put himself on the radar when he did the soundtrack for a Kurt Russell film about Elvis that came, I think it came out about 77 or so. And, you know, Kurt Russell portrayed a young Elvis, and they needed somebody to sing for the soundtrack, and they hired this guy out of Nashville by the name of Ronnie McDowell. He had a voice that sounded eerily similar to Elvis's, and the movie was a hit, and it helped launch Ronnie McDowell's career. He sort of, it was yet another Elvis imitator. I wound up a bass player for him for a time, but the cool thing was is that Ronnie McDowell would hire Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana. So I found myself playing with Elvis's old bandmates.
Hmm.
We did one gig that even included the Jordanaires. But there's a story Ronnie McDowell was fond of telling about a young Elvis Presley was, you know, signed by Colonel Tom Parker, who at the time was managing Hank Snow, a country music singer. And Colonel Tom Parker thought it would be a good idea to have Elvis, you know, go on tour with Hank Snow and open up for him.
Hmm.
Because Hank Snow was, you know, an established country music star of the Grand Ole Opry, and you could hear him on WSM anytime. So he thought it would be a good way to introduce Elvis Presley to a wider audience to have him open up for Hank Snow on these tours. The problem was that, you know, when Hank Snow came out on stage, we're talking about a guy, he was from Nova Scotia, he was a little bit short guy, and he was traditional country music singer, and he would dress up in cowboy boots and a little cowboy outfit and a cowboy hat, and he'd play an acoustic guitar and sing cowboy songs. And the problem was that when Elvis, who had Scotty, Bill, and DJ Fontana, finished their 30-minute opening set, nobody in the audience had any interest in Hank Snow.
They'd killed the vibe for Hank.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, they were only supposed to do 30 minutes, so they would get off stage, and here would come Hank Snow and his band, and they're all dressed in cowboy outfits, and they're doing country music. And inevitably, the audience would begin to chant, "Elvis, Elvis, Elvis." And they say for the first couple or three nights that Hank was patient with the situation and handled it gracefully. But like on the fourth night, and Hank Snow's into his third song, and the audience once again begins chanting, "Elvis, Elvis, Elvis." And Hank Snow stomped his little cowboy boot down on the stage and stopped the band. And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you just let me finish this song. I'll get that little son of a bitch out here just as quick as I can."
Why'd you pick this song?
Oh, it was one of the ones that, you know, Kurt and I have discovered the Sun Sessions in the late 70s. And it was, you know, a standout on Elvis's Sun Records. I'd also like to mention Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio. They were another fantastic rockabilly band from Tennessee. But, you know, Elvis, Johnny Burnett, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, those guys, you know, would take in the rock and roll aspect of the music that came from Tennessee and, you know, the South.
I host a different show that's not about music, and I had a guy on. He's a Florida journalist. He wrote a book about interesting things that happened in Florida, and one of them was the story of Colonel Tom Parker before he was Elvis's manager. Wound up as the dog catcher up in Tampa, and he ended up scamming him out of a whole bunch of money. And he had like a pet cemetery that he had people donating to that he didn't. He kept the money. Anyway, I just thought you seem like you might be interested in interesting Elvis adjacent history.
To this day, I've got a copy of, you know, a 1956 published Elvis Presley jukebox, you know, songbook. And on the very back page, it says, there's a little ad that says, "Join the Elvis Presley fan club. Send a dollar to Colonel Tom Parker in Madison, Tennessee." And I remember where his house used to be in Madison. It was right on Gallatin Road. And Elvis would stay there when he came to Nashville. There was a guest house by the pool. And Elvis would stay there. And it had the same type of wrought iron gates on the, you know, by the, at the front top of the drive that Elvis finally had at Graceland. But they tore that house down there in Nashville, and there's a car wash there now. But yeah, you
know. Is it called Elvis's? Or?
Oh, it's just a damn shame. But, yeah, if you join the Elvis Presley fan club.
Did you join?
No. It was a little out of date, but if you sent a dollar to join the Elvis Presley fan club, that dollar went straight into Colonel Tom Parker's pocket.
So you live in Clarksdale now.
I do.
What's your first memory of Clarksdale?
The first time I ever came to Clarksdale was, it was like the summer of 1985, and I arrived late on a Monday night and traveling with a couple of friends, and they were exhausted. We were all pretty tired, but I was so excited to be in Clarksdale, you know, because I'd read the blues histories and, you know, I knew that Clarksdale was, you know, the absolute beating heart of the blues out of Mississippi. So in spite of my fatigue, road fatigue, on a Monday night, I was like, man, I gotta find some music around here somewhere. So I went to the bar. We were staying at the Holiday Inn, so I went down to the bar, and a couple of white guys watching Monday Night Football. I said, man, where's the nearest blues club? And they looked at me like, are you crazy? And they just pointed, you know, in general direction, and boom, I hit the door, and I was walking down the street and crossed the tracks and heard music coming from a club. And I found the front door of this club, and as I recall it, there was a Dempster dumpster on either side of the entrance of this club. And, you know, I just fearlessly went right through the front door. And when I did, there were about a half a dozen blankets. It was probably, you know, 12:30 at night, you know, on a Monday night. There was maybe half a dozen black people. And, you know, I come busting through the front door, and they all turn around and look. And they all turn back around and ignored me. And I walk in, I look around, and they're all drinking tall Budweisers. I tell the bartender, I'll have a tall Budweiser. And they were playing some kind of modern disco-like music. And I noticed that there was a guy dressed up in a basketball uniform. And he had a DJ booth. He was back there spinning records at DJ booth. And so I went by, walked back, said, hey, man, you got any blues records? And he big grin, said, yeah, I got some blues records. And he started throwing on Elmore James and B.B. King. And the next thing I know, I'm on the dance floor with a couple of other black guys. And we're out there just shuffling all around. Closed the place down. You know, it must have been 2:30. Closed the place down. So I got to walk back to the Holiday Inn. And I'm walking back toward the hotel. And it's, you know, pitch black. 2:30 at night, and I'm a pedestrian, and a police car comes up behind me and turns its blue lights on. I get pulled over while I'm on foot. The cop, you know, big white cop gets out and goes, you got the ID?
What the hell are you doing here?
Yeah, what are you doing? You got the ID? And the only ID I could produce was a library card from Nashville.
Wow.
I didn't have a driver's license at the time for some reason. But yeah, he was just, I just frustrated the hell out of me. But he could tell I was somebody from Nashville, a white person. He says, don't you know how much trouble you could get into on this side of town this time of night? And I came this close to saying, I've been over here all night and you're the only trouble I've run into. But the next morning, And I went right back over to the black side of town, and I'm walking down the street, and I find a 61 Chevrolet Impala sitting in front of a barber shop. And the 61 Chevrolet Impala has a stuffed monkey wearing a three-piece suit and a pork pie hat with a cigar stuck out of its mouth sitting in the passenger seat. And I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at the barbershop, and I was like, well, this must be the place. So I go in, and as it turns out, it was Wade Walton's barbershop. And he's a famous Clarksdale local. He ran the barbershop for years. Story goes that he had cut Howlin' Wolf's hair. You know, he knew everybody. But went in and, you know, got a load of him. He showed us the juke joint that he had in the back and performed on a straight razor on his leather strap and played harmonica, had a jukebox back there. So, you know, the first trip I had to Clarksdale was just like, wow, this place is completely different. And then, again, I mentioned Ronnie McDowell earlier. We came back from Nashville down to play a casino in Tunica called the Horseshoe. And we played, and I was with, on that gig, I was with Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana and Ronnie McDowell. And we played Friday and Saturday night. So on Saturday afternoon, there was nothing to do. And I had a couple friends with me. And we drove down to Clarksdale. And as it turns out, there was the Sunflower Festival was going on that afternoon. So this is the second time I'd seen Clarksdale in, you know, 20 years had gone by. And so I'm seeing Clarksdale again. And I was like, oh, man, look what they're doing now. They got a blues festival going. That's when I began to seriously contemplate, well, you know, that might be a way cool place to move to and live, because I was frustrated with Nashville.
When did you make the move?
Oh, I must have been about 2013, if I had to guess.
Okay. Nashville's changed a lot.
Tell me.
Do you ever go back?
Well, I still own a rental. I own a house in Madison that serves as a rental property for me. And it's okay. You know, I got a married couple that both work at Vanderbilt. So I have to go back occasionally to pull routine maintenance on the house. But Nashville is so intensely overcrowded and busy and hectic that, you know, I know the back way into that property. So I just try to slide in and slide out and interact as little as I possibly can. I just want to get out of Nashville as quick as I can every time I go up there. I go up there, I take care of the business at the house, and I get the hell out of there.
How many days a week now living in Clarksdale are you either experiencing music or performing it?
Every day. And if I'm not performing it, I'm at home practicing. It's, you know, it's all I want to do. I mean, that's where I am. I'm 67. How much time do I have left? I want to try and take advantage of what time I have left to get as good at performance as I possibly can.
You have your own band besides playing along with Big A, right?
Well, actually,
it's a trio.
As it turns out, I generally play bass for Anthony, but you know, since I've been in Clarksdale, I've been working furiously on my blues skills and my repertoire. And I finally convinced Anthony to play bass for me. So I've just recently begun to book gigs. And so Anthony and Lee are my rhythm section when I'm not playing bass for them.
Wow.
And, oh, boy, it's quite something.
What were your blues skills like when you moved there in 2013?
Little or none.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause I'd played country and bluegrass, and you know, you're going to be hard pressed to find a blues band in Nashville, really.
So you came to town and said, "I'm going to bone up and I'm going to learn this."
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
Huh.
That's what I've gone there to do.
Hmm.
Well, I don't want to be in Nashville, and I love the blues. And as I said earlier, I've played in a hell of a lot of bands over the course of 40 years or more, and this is my favorite one. I feel, you know, really lucky that it's, you know, unfolded as it has.
Does the trio that Anthony's playing bass some for have a name?
That's been a bone of contention. I'd like to call it—
It's a work in progress.
Yeah, it's a work in progress. I'd like to call it Cottonmouth, because these guys, man, they smoke pot every time you get together with them. They're always smoking pot. And I notice I'm playing bass for them. It's like every time I play bass for you guys, I always wind up with Cottonmouth. And so I was wanting to name the band Cottonmouth, but Roger didn't like the name. And so they,
Roger's smiling.
Yeah, they want to. It was suggested that we use the name the Delta Kings, but as it turns out, now there's a band from Arkansas called the Arkansas Delta Kings. So
the Delta Cottonmouths. Everybody will think it's about snakes.
The name of the band doesn't matter so much to me as what the band sounds like.
How would you describe it? I mean, you guys just a straight blues trio? Oh,
straight blues trio.
Playing some original, some classics,
I've not written any compositions. I do everything from Robert Johnson covers to Muddy Waters, Otis Spann, If you serious blues guys, I'm attempting it.
Was there a song or a couple songs that you really spent a lot of time on at the beginning to get it in you?
Well, that's one of the problems I've had is that I've gone at it macro instead of micro. That is, there's a lot of blues artists, and all those artists have a lot of recordings, and I've dove into it head first. And if you were to look at my books, you would see that I've got dozens, if not hundreds, of tunes, written down, all the lyric and, what chord changes might be necessary. So I realize at long last that I've taken off too big a bite, and I'm sorting through that collection of songs, and I'm trying to whittle it down to its pure distilled essence. I'm trying to get the very best out of it, picking out the very best songs.
It's time for your third song.
All right.
Allman Brothers.
Okay.
How do you want to go with this one?
Let her rip.
This is Preston Rumbaugh's third and final song on this week's episode of Three Song Stories. This is Don't Want You No More, It's Not My Cross to Bear by the Allman Brothers Band from their 1969 debut album titled The Allman Brothers Band. So what's the story with that one?
Oh, I was maybe 13 years old. And, I told you earlier that my grandmother was, quite the Bible thumper, and she required me and all of us kids to go to summer Christian camp every year. And it was summertime, and I had, it was coming up. It was right around the corner, and I had to go to the summer Christian camp. But it just so happened that I had a little fold-up Magnavox stereo system, had a couple little speakers, and the turntable would fold up, mm-hmm. and you'd put it all together, and it was like a little suitcase. And I'd heard everybody talking about the Allman Brothers Band. Man, this new band is, really good. You got to hear this band. And so I tweaked my curiosity, and on the Sunday before I was meant to go, actually it's Saturday before I was meant to go to the summer camp, I went downtown. I went to Walgreens, and I went in and going through the record bin, and I found the Allman Brothers Band's first album, a copy of the first album. And I plucked it out of the bin and took it up to the counter, and I paid like $4 and change for it at that time. And, packed it up with all my stuff. And on Sunday, went to the summer camp, and I, go to the boys' dorm. I got, my little trunk of clothes and whatnot. And I've got my little stereo, and I've got my fresh copy of the Allman Brothers Band. I said, man, I just can't wait to hear these guys. So I get in the boys' dorm and, unpack the stereo, set it up. And I peel the plastic off the record and pull the paper sleeve out and pull the vinyl out of the sleeve. And I put that platter on the turntable and set the needle down, and it absolutely changed. It turned me into an adult. It changed everything for me. I listened to the first side of that record, and I was just gobsmacked, just jaw dropped. And I turned the record over and listened to the second side, and again, I was just astonished. So I turned the record over and I listened to the first side. I turned the record over and I listened to the second side.
Were you supposed to be going somewhere?
Hell no. For 3 days. The only place I would go was over to the cafeteria to get something to eat. I ignored all the instructors.
So you went away to church camp and said, I'm just going to stay here in my room and listen to this Allman Brothers
band. Yeah, absolutely. I completely rebelled. I didn't want to have anything to do with anybody else. I didn't want to go to any of the classes. To hell with the instructors. I've already heard about Jonah and the Whale. I'm going to listen. I need to listen to this record. And so I kept flipping that record over and over and listening to it. I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, they finally kicked me out on Wednesday. And I was like, whatever. And I went home, set the stereo off again, and kept listening to that record. But I think that's what really set me on the path. I mean, I would like to sound like this, you know, just instrumentally and lyrically. It was an introduction into a whole nother world that I could relate to, too. I mean, you listen to the lyric, what Greg was singing about. It's like, yeah, man, I could identify with, you know, because they were from Dixon County. Their grandparents lived in Dixon County, and they were born in Nashville. They grew up in Nashville, and I went to Castle Heights Military Academy for a time. They did, too. Mm-hmm. I had so much in common with them, but to hear the music they played was just... It's transformative.
How long between getting kicked out of summer or, you know, church camp and then going home and heading out on your own? You said about 14. You said about 13.
Yeah, it was about, you know.
Was there a straight line between those two?
Oh, kinda? Absolutely. You know, because when I broke out that Allman Brothers record and listened to it, I might have been 13. And, you know, I think that's when my rebellious streak, you know, really began to surface.
Well, you said you became a grown-up. You said, well, I'm going to go live on my own.
And so, well, it wasn't that so much as my father could not control me. Mm. I mean, and he, let me tell you, brother, he tried everything in the book, and he didn't. I would have died before I let that guy tell me what to do. Mm. So he invited me to leave, and I took him up on it. I said, I'm out of here.
Did you take the little suitcase record player?
No, I didn't take that. But I had a backpack. And by then, I had amassed, I must have had 30 LPs. And I packed them all up in that backpack. And my dad drove me to my aunt's house in Nashville and dropped me off there. And she was foolish enough to let me talk her into dropping me off on Highway 70. And I hitchhiked back over to Lebanon, where I had a friend that I'd gone to Castle Heights with. But man, carrying those records in that backpack, when I got to my friend's house in Lebanon, I said, man, you can have my albums. I can't bear the weight of them. So that was the end of my vinyl collecting days.
Well, it's time for a speed round. You ready for a speed round?
I guess I have to be.
Do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life that you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, sure. back in the late 70s, I grew a goatee similar to the one I have now. And when, you know, it came to full fruition, my friend Kurt saw me, and he started laughing, and he called me Herm. And I said, why are you calling me Herm? Is it because you look like Herm? And I said, well, who the hell is Herm? And he said, don't you remember I think it was an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies where the goofy son's name?
Jethro.
Jethro got involved with a group of beatniks. And the leader of the beatniks was a guy by the name of Herm, and he had a goatee. So, yeah, they started calling me Herm, and then they called me Herm for years.
Hmm.
And, you know, I was fine with it.
Do you do karaoke?
No.
Have you ever?
No. One time I played a gig with a band from Nashville, and it turned out that it was an out-of-town gig. We traveled to get to the gig, and it turned out to be in a karaoke bar, and some of the people singing karaoke were better than our lead singer. It was so embarrassing.
If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you enter the arena to?
Iggy Pop Raw Power.
What would your wrestler name be?
Herm. with all capital letters and an exclamation point.
How do you spell Herm?
H-E-R-M.
Oh, there's an E in there. I thought maybe it was a U or maybe just H-R-M. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
No, it's a hot dog.
Okay. What activities or pursuits make you lose track of time the most?
Oh, I pick up a Gibson guitar. It's time flies out the window.
How many guitars do you have these days?
Too many. If you know how many you have, you don't have enough.
Do you have more bass guitars or guitar guitars?
Oh, guitars. I've only got one. You only need one bass.
That's what I was kind of thinking as I said it.
But I got all kinds of guitars.
People don't end up, I guess maybe somebody out there has got a wall full of bass guitars.
Or some eccentric bass player.
Which you don't fall into that category at all.
I just play bass because there's money in it.
What would you say is the most overplayed song of all time?
Just about anything you hear on the radio.
That's a really good answer to that question. If you could broadcast a song into the head of everybody on the planet in one big magic moment, what song would you play for them?
I'd play B.B. King's version of Waiting for Your Call.
If you could only have one album and that became music for you, which would you pick?
Wow, like a desert island album.
Yeah.
That would be a tough one. Boy, I might have to go again with B.B. King's One Kind Favor.
What would your 14-year-old self, who we've talked about some today, think of who you are today and what you've done since then?
Oh, you lazy son of a bitch. You could have done better than this. You know, get on the stick.
Well, he'd be maybe happy you were playing the stringed instrument.
You're
every
going
day.
The right direction. Just work harder at it.
All right. It's time for you to recommend three people that you'll share this with that you think we might be able to get on. And they don't have to be local. We do remote recordings.
Three people that you want me to share this with?
Yeah. Three people that you'll tell you are on a show. It's a marketing technique, Herm.
Just like friends of mine?
Yeah, anybody. People you play with, people, you know, your brothers, you know, whoever.
Like okay.
Just three people.
Mark David and Stacy Kirkpatrick, Jeff and Diane Wells, and Jeff Jennings.
Three friends of yours?
Yeah.
Okay. When this comes out, tell them you were on a show, and then we'll try to get them on.
Okay.
Any final thoughts? You've done it.
Oh, that's it. I've enjoyed it.
Preston brought in a guitar and an amp, so this week's parting tune is him performing Maggie Campbell Blues, originally recorded by Tommy Johnson back in the late 1920s. We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is host and online content producer. Our production assistant is Jared Gonzalez. Chris Duffus is executive producer. And our theme song was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Keep listening.
Who that gal that come walking up and down the road? Look like Maggie, but she's walking too slow. Who that yonder come walking up and down the road? Look like Maggie, but she walking a little too slow. Woman I love got great long curly hair. Her mother and her father don't allow me there. You know the woman that I'm loving got great long curly hair. Her mother and her father-in-law, they don't allow me there. She's the meanest woman I most ever seen. I asked her for water and she brought me gasoline, you know, she's the meanest woman I've most ever seen. Ask her for water and she brought me gasoline. Thank you. won't be back no more. The next time you see me, your head be white as snow. I ain't coming back no more. The next time you see me, your head gonna be as white as snow. Next time you see me, your head be white as snow. Next time you see me, your head be white as snow.